Good morning. Let's begin with a word of prayer. I want to thank Walker for asking me to teach. Walker did a great job with the first 12 chapters. He's asked me to take the next 12 chapters. And as he found, as he went through, there's a lot there. And I hope we can get all of this covered. I appreciate Walker in a lot of ways. And I want Walker, Denise, cover his ears. I know you guys love him and appreciate him. A friend of mine said to me recently, he said, you know, I don't have many old friends. And then he added good old friends. And of course, there are several things about that. You got to be old to have old friends, right? Walker has been an old friend. He's been a good old friend, and I appreciate him. We're lucky to have him as one of the elders. Matter of fact, we're lucky to have all of our elders. I'm terribly impressed. Don't know them as well as I know Walker, but what I have seen, I have really, really learned to appreciate. In the book of Genesis, we're going to start another chapter, if you will allow me that terminology. The book of Genesis was written with very specific purposes in mind, and Walker went over this, and all I'm doing is just restating it. There were certain events that God wanted to cover, and He essentially talks about those events, and then he fast forwards to the next event that he wants to talk about. There would have been a lot of things, obviously, he could have talked about in the lives of a lot of men, but they were not pertinent to the story. In chapter 5, right before, after all of the events in the garden, he wants to fast forward to the next event, and basically he does the genealogies, and he goes through Adam begets Seth, Enosh, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, and he gets to the next event that he wants to talk about, and he talks about Noah. After he finishes the story that was so important in the scheme of things, in us understanding that God simply doesn't tolerate sin, will not tolerate sin, and was willing to cleanse the earth and start over. He again fast forwards to the next event that's important. In chapter 10, he talks about the generations of Noah, his three sons. But then he's going to pick up in chapter 11 and talk about the scattering, in which he explains how we got all the languages that we, at least the basic languages that we started out with. And then at the end of chapter 11, he's going to fast forward again from Noah. And he's going to start with Shem, Arphaxad, Selah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, Abraham. Because Abraham is part of the scheme that God is unfolding and developing. He began in Genesis 3, immediately after the fall, to communicate the fact that there was a plan. And Abraham is going to be a central, I'll say the central figure in the book of Genesis, because through him, God is going to unfold for the first time. People are going to get a glimpse, at least a glimpse, of what his plan was going to be. And in Genesis, the 12th chapter, he starts by talking about calling Abraham. It's important for us to actually go back in chapter 11 a little bit and talk about the fact that Terah took his family and moved from what is, you'll see the figure of the chart, the picture of the map. And he is in Ur, and I don't have a pointer, but it's on the lower right-hand part of the chart. And that's where they're living. The city of Ur, which is an interesting study in and of itself, was not what we generally think of as some small... the city of Ur was actually, and we'll talk about this in just a minute, it was a very large city. It was a very commercial city. It was a very strong city. Abraham was living there. I guess it's possible to be a country boy living outside of a large city. Some of us are. But he was living in an urban area that was very, very clearly developed when God calls him to leave Ur of the Chaldees. Before we get into that, there are two or three charts and maps I want to show you to give you some sense of. We're not advancing. There we go. I apologize for this one being, what I wanted you to see is give you some sense of the size of the area we're talking about here. You overlaid in a blurred way is the state of Texas. From Ur of the Chaldees to Haran, it was about 650 miles, and from Haran down into the land of Canaan, another 400 to 450 miles. It's not a huge landmass. The land that God is going to give Abraham would fit into the northern part of the state of Alabama. But as the little boy says, when you walk, it gets really big. When you drive, it's really small, right? They're going to walk from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran. They're going to stay there a number of years, and then God's going to call Abraham, and he's going to separate from his family. All right. Are we advancing? Sorry. All right. Again, this gives you some sense of the direction. We're going to go to Haran, to Shechem, to Bethel Ai, going down into Egypt, come back into the area of Bethel Ai, and then end up around Hebron. Abraham is going to live in the desert, the Negev region, a little bit around Beersheba. All right. Did we skip some? All right. Well, here we are. God is going to initially call Abraham when he's living in the Ur of the Chaldees. It's interesting, in Genesis, the 12th chapter, verses 1 and 2, he talks about the call, or actually chapter 11, he's going to talk about the call, and he's going to leave Haran, where they've been living, and move down into the land of Canaan. I'm on a different chart here. I apologize. Anyway, this is a little bit about Ur of the Chaldees. 250,000 population, approximately, with a sophisticated banking system, a sophisticated educational system. Abraham, potentially, could have been a very educated man coming from the city that he comes from. All right, let's move forward. The city of Ur was the largest and most powerful city in the Third Dynasty. It controlled all of the land, the dark brown, and influenced, had all the rest of that area that is colored there, basically under its thumb. And that would have been just prior to the birth of Abraham, that it would have been the capital of the city-state. This is a rebuilt ziggurat in the city of what is the city of Ur. The steel there on the left-hand side is basically a rolling seal for one of the kings of Ur of the Chaldees. And anyway, I just thought it would be of interest. This is a portrait inside a tomb in Egypt of some Hebrews that came down. I just thought that would be interesting to see as well. All right, let's move forward. The question that I think I have to ask is, why was Abraham chosen? I mean, think about it. Is Abraham the only righteous man that we've encountered up to this point? Can you think of another righteous man? I can think of several. Enoch? Why didn't God choose Enoch? We're going to encounter one in this lesson. Melchizedek is a righteous man. Why didn't he choose Melchizedek? Don't know the answer to that. There are several through time. Noah was a righteous man, and yet God doesn't choose him to be part of the lineage. He chooses Abraham. All right. In Romans 9th chapter, one of the interesting passages, Romans has a lot to say about Abraham. Galatians has a lot to say about Abraham. Hebrews has a lot to say about Abraham. When God says a little later, I'm going to make your name great, he does. And in Romans 9, he's going to make the argument that some choices are just choices. He says, there are times when I pick a bad man because he's a bad man. Pharaoh. Sometimes I pick a good man because he's a good man. Sometimes choices are just choices. And in the illustration he uses there are the two sons of Isaac. He said, why did I pick one? It was not based on anything they did, either good or bad. I had to make a choice. There are times in history, particularly once God made the promise, that choices just have to be made. And it's not always based on the caliber of the person or the faith of the person. In this instance, I apologize, guys. This thing's... all right, let me see if I can catch up. All right. One of the interesting things in Genesis 12, verses 1 and 2, is that he tells him to get out of the land, get away from your kin, and out of your father's house. What's interesting is in Acts, the 7th chapter, where we learn that God first spoke to Abraham while he was in Ur of the Chaldees, not in Haran. One of the things we learn there is that he tells him, I want you out of the land and away from your kin. Well, there's a reason for that, and we'll learn that as we talk a little more about that. But when you get here in the Genesis, the 12th chapter, he adds another. He said, I want you to get out of your father's house. Why is that going to be important? Well, as we're going to see, Abraham was chosen because of his faith, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know. In Galatians 3, verses 6 through 9, he's going to talk about the fact that we are sons of Abraham because if we have faith, we are sons of Abraham. It's not based on his physical seed, but it's based on our faith because he was the father of those who were faithful. Hebrews, the 11th chapter, talks a lot about that as well, where he makes the point that Abraham was a man of great faith. And what's interesting in all of this is Abraham's background. All right, thank you. Abraham's background is not particularly stellar. In Acts, the 7th chapter, in Joshua 24, he's going to make the point. Oh, we did? Okay. In Joshua, the 24th chapter, Joshua makes the point. He says, our fathers worshiped idols, and he specifically mentions Terah and Nahor. They were idol worshipers. Abraham apparently stands out from his kinfolk. You know, that's not the first time. I've got kinfolks that are not faithful. It's not unusual to have two brothers and one be extremely faithful and one be unfaithful. It's not unusual to have a parent who's faithful and a child's not faithful. What's interesting is that Abraham was living in a time where he's surrounded by idol worshipers. Let's see if I can catch up here. Thank you. We know... I'm sorry?
When you use the clicker face this way.
That would help. I apologize, guys. It's anyway, we can do this without it.
It reacted.
Did it? Moving slow? Okay. We know for a fact that there are instances where we know they were idol worshipers. Rebekah, Genesis 31, 30 through 35, steals her brother, or her father, Laban's, household idols. You remember the interaction between the two patriarchs. What's interesting to me in all of this is that Abraham, apparently in the midst of a city, an urban city where there were lots of distractions, where there were lots of opportunities to involve himself in a lot of things, does not, even when his family is not faithful to God. Apparently, Terah knew God because God appeared to them, appeared to Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, Acts 7, and Terah agrees to move at least part of the way to Haran, and then from there, Abraham is called out of his father's house. All right. Yeah. Walker put a slide up the other day that was interesting, and this is a similar slide. There were lots of the patriarchs that were living during Abraham's time. Now, we don't know if he had access to any of them, but one of the ones that's interesting to me is Shem. The red line, the squiggly red line up there, is basically the birth of Abraham. You've got Shem, Arphaxad, Selah, and Eber, all of who lived extensive amounts of time while Abraham's alive. Shem would have been in the ark. Shem would have seen the world destroyed. We don't know what kind of man Shem was because he really doesn't talk about him. But Abraham very easily could have had access to men who were men of faith, men who had seen what God had done. And we don't know if, we don't know why Abraham was as Abraham, why his faith was what it was. But he certainly had opportunity. Next slide, guys. God chooses him because of his faith. He asks him to leave, he leaves. He doesn't question. He's not a perfect man. We're going to see that as we go through the life. One of the things that differentiates the Bible from some of the other religious books that have been written is that the Bible shows all of the character, even the righteous character, shows their warts. And he's going to make that the point here. We're going to see at least a couple of different times where Abraham doesn't have the kind of faith he should have had in a particular situation, and where he failed to believe in God. But overall, and I think that's the lesson to all of us, is that we don't have to be, our faith doesn't have to be perfect all the time. Our faith ultimately has to win. That there are going to be times when we doubt. There are going to be times when we stumble and fall, as Abraham did. And yet, Abraham is placed spiritually on a pedestal for us because of the kind of faith that he had and what it motivated him to do. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the promises that are mentioned up here. In Genesis 2, he's going to say, initially, I'm going to make you a great nation. We'll pick these up a little later as we go through the life of Abraham. I just wanted to introduce them this morning. In chapter 12 and verse 2, he says, I'll make you a great nation. In chapter 13 and verse 15, he says, it's going to be like the dust of the earth. If you can count the dust, you'll be able to count your seed. He indeed did make him a great nation, physically, number-wise. And even Ishmael, we're going to see Ishmael. The Arabs primarily come from Ishmael. When I was in the Middle East years ago, we were in Hebron, and there's a church built there over technically what they think of as the Cave of Machpelah, and I tell this story fairly often. There was one building over the top of the cave, and it had three wings, and one was a Christian wing, one was a Jewish wing, and one was an Arab Muslim wing, and they had kind of a joint conservative, what's the word? All of them revere Abraham. He did make him a great nation. His descendants were going to be like the sands of the sea later on, he's going to say. And of course, those prophecies include us, not just the physical seed in some of those prophecies, but he did make him a great nation. He's going to go on and say, I will bless you. In chapter 13 and verse 2, he blessed him financially. There are several passages. The one in Acts where Stephen is preaching his lesson, he says that he didn't get even a foot of the land of Palestine while he was alive. God promised it to him. It would be given to his seed, but he didn't inherit any of it. The only piece he owned was the piece he bought, the cave where he buried his wife, where ultimately he's going to be buried. But God does bless him. In chapter 15 and verse 1, he says, I will be your shield. And we're going to see as we study through this that there indeed were times where Abraham takes 318 trained men from his house and chases down four kings. Chases them about 300 miles, looks like. And overthrows them. These were kings that had come down and had captured all of the nations above in the middle part on both sides of the Jordan River as they come down out of Mesopotamia back from close to around where Abraham originally was around Ur of the Chaldees. There were four kings from up there that come down, and they're going to come down and they're going to destroy all the nations around them, subjugate the nations around them, and then ultimately Sodom, Gomorrah, and the cities of the plains. So we're talking about quite a sizable group of people. And yet Abraham's going to take 318, kind of reminds you of another story where 300 was used, doesn't it? Going to take 318 men who were born in his house, going to chase them down, going to defeat them, going to get everything that they took back. So God was indeed a shield for him. He's going to say, he says, I will make your name great. I didn't go through and list every time Abraham's name is mentioned. But I know there are at least 9 times in the Old Testament where his name is mentioned in the prophets, the Psalms, the prophets, 3 times in the prophets, I think. In the New Testament, there are at least 27 times, and I just did a quick... And then the book of Romans is going to have a couple of chapters. The book of Galatians, the book of Hebrews, he's going to be named and talked about extensively in there because of who he was and what he was. And that's incredibly important to us because it's based on what God did through him that we have hope, that we have our righteousness. If we attain righteousness again, we have that on the basis of the kind of faith that Abraham had. He's going to go on to say in this passage, I'm going to bless those that bless you and curse them that curse you. And we're going to see examples of that. Even when Abraham misbehaves and tells Pharaoh that Sarah is not his wife, what happens? What happens? God intervenes. Abimelech, a little later on, same thing, same lie. I identify a little bit with Abraham here. You know, he didn't just do it once. He did it twice. Well, I've been guilty of that a few times. We knew better. He probably knew better. Still succumbs to the temptation to do it. And finally, he talks about, in thee shall all nations of the earth be blessed. In Galatians 3, he says, those that are of faith are sons of Abraham. Book of Ephesians is going to talk about the fact that there is no longer a difference between Jew and Gentile. That God has broken down the wall, which was the law that stood between them, and both of them have access the same way through faith. And we'll talk about some of that as we go on. In Acts, the third chapter, in verse 23, Peter's preaching the second recorded sermon. And at the end of that, he's going to say in verse 19 that the times of refreshing have come from the presence of the Lord in the form of Jesus. And then in the latter part of that chapter, he says that he specifically talks about the blessing promise that God made to Abraham, and says specifically that it came through Christ, and that he blessed all of you, he says, talking to the people, by turning you away from your iniquities. Now, what he's talking about there is not turning them away from the sins that they're guilty of in their life. He's talking about turning them away from the penalty of their sin. The Old Testament prophets are clear when it talks about that. So he specifically talks about the blessing promise in relation to the forgiveness of sins that comes through Christ. And of course, he talks about the land promise here in chapter 12. In verse 7, he is specific about giving you the land. In chapter 13, after he and Lot split up, God tells Abraham, he says, look to the north, look to the east, look to the south, look to the west. I'm going to give it all to you. In chapter 17, 15, verse 18, he says, I'm going to give you from the river of Egypt all the way to the Euphrates. Well, Abraham knew exactly what he's talking about because he had been to Egypt. I guess he was going to Egypt. And he'd certainly been, he'd crossed the Euphrates coming from the Ur. From Ur, he had to cross the Euphrates. So he was familiar with these. The only person that got close to getting all of that was Solomon. He was really, really close. And had he remained faithful, I have no doubt that God would have given him, they would have inhabited. He controlled much of that, even though they didn't inhabit that. But one of the things he also told them was that you need to be careful that the land doesn't vomit you out like it vomited the Amorites. And he says the way you do that is you obey my laws. You keep the laws that I'm going to give you, and the land will be yours. All right, next chart, please. Again, I've put a chart that kind of gives you some sense of the way of travel in Palestine. There were three primary routes. The one on the left, the squiggly line on the left, is called the King's Highway, if you can't read that. Then you have one that coming down from Damascus that would have gone over. There were a set of hills, and you'll, if you ever look at a cross section, I've got one somewhere. If you ever look at a cross section, you'll see that you couldn't just travel anywhere. There were three primary modes or three primary routes through the land. And Abraham is going to probably travel down what is the King's Highway, the one on the right-hand side. You can see Shechem right dead center, if you can read that. So he's going to come down the King's Highway. He's going to come to the Jabbok River, which would have been a valley, a depression. He's going to go through that, then go up into the mountainous region around Shechem, and that's going to be the first place that he settles. All right. Thoughts or comments? I really haven't given you guys a chance to. You can see. Next slide. Thank you. Again, you get some sense of the terrain, you understand more why there are certain routes of travel through the land. The land is pretty rugged in spots. So he would have come almost halfway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. You can see a depression there. That's the Jabbok River. He would have come across, gone straight up into the area of Shechem. Okay, next slide. Again, that gives you some sense of travel. Okay? All right. The city of Shechem was significant. I know you're going, wait a minute, we got four chapters. We're gonna cover them, I promise you, Lord willing. Shechem was important, is important. When we find Abraham, the first thing he does when he goes to Shechem is he builds a what? He builds an altar. He does it everywhere he goes. And he worships God, and he offers burnt offerings. He worships God, and then he moves from there. What we're going to find in the book of Deuteronomy, interestingly enough, the first place the children of Israel, Abraham's descendants, the first place they camp when they come into the land, finally, is in Shechem. It seems, based on what I can understand, is they went past Jericho and Ai and camped at Shechem and then came back and did the, there's some question. Either way, whether they, that's the first place they had a long-term camp, was in Shechem. In Deuteronomy, the 27th chapter, before they go into the land, Moses is giving his sermons and he's telling them, look, when you go in, what I want you to do is I want you to build an altar on Mount Ebal across from Mount Gerizim, which is right where the city of Shechem was. And he says, then I want you, I want half of you to get on one mountain, I want half of you to get on the other mountain. And on this altar, you're going to plaster it and you're going to write the law. You're going to offer burnt offerings, and then we're going, after the ceremony, in essence, we're going to eat. And so they, half of them on one mountain, half on the other mountain, and they would shout the blessings. The priest would shout the blessings, and they would say amen, and then they would shout the curses, and they would say amen, and they repeated those. It was critical for them to understand. And it's significant, I think, that the first place they camp is the first place that Abraham camped when he got into the land. And then, of course, in the book of Joshua, you see the fulfillment of that. All right. Any thoughts or comments? I know we're kind of blowing through some of this you know what they say, if your audience doesn't ask questions, you're either doing a great job or you're doing a terrible job. All right. When Abraham gets to Shechem, again, he builds an altar as he often did. The next place he's going to see, I'm a little ahead on this chart, so don't look at this chart. In the book of Genesis chapter 12, we're going to have him journeying down into Egypt, and we're going to have the interaction there. We've already talked about that a little bit. One of the interesting things, one of the interesting things about this is that Abraham probably was, when he was moving, by this time, he's moving a small city. I mean, think of it. He probably had somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 3,000 people, some have guesstimated, that were part of his group. And they based that, in some extent, based on the amount of wealth that they talk about him having. But the other thing is, he had 318 men, fighting men. And they do a little bit of math. Each one of those is married, right? Each one of those has one kid. Then you got a few of their parents. I mean, you know, it doesn't take long for you to go, wow, oh, I hadn't thought about that. I always pictured, and when you see these pictures in the kids' classes, you see, you know, a couple of tens. He's moving a small city along with his herds and all of the servants. When he left with the 318 men, he didn't worry about work getting done. He was gone for a while. Probably more than a month. It didn't work because it was a self-sustaining city in essence that he's moving there. Often when a little later on we're going to see the two angels are going to visit. And it says he ran out and he grabbed a calf and I often thought, wow, you know, for me to go grab a calf and cook it is going to be a major. Well, he lived in a small city. You know, He would have pointed, and the guy would have grabbed it, and they would have swarmed it and cooked it. And we don't think about that. When he moved into Egypt, it says that Pharaoh basically gave him a certain amount of respect. Well, he also would have noticed him. You move a small city into my region, I'm going to notice that, and he would have noticed that. He was a wealthy man. He was a man that could protect himself and with God on his side, certainly. So when he moves down, he's noticed. Wherever he moves, he's noticed. And, you know, Sarah must have been a knockout, okay? I mean, she's an old woman. And these guys are still saying, wow. And so it seems like everywhere she goes, at least certain places he went, he was concerned about that. It was something that caused him to lose a little bit of sleep at night. Anyway, you got interactions with Pharaoh. Pharaoh, God intervenes, as he does with Abimelech a little later on, and Pharaoh sends him out. And, of course, at that point, he goes back into the land. And then in chapter 13, we have the division with Lot. Has the second bell rung? We have the division with Lot. And we'll talk a little about that as we go forward. Lot, they both of them were extremely wealthy. And literally the area they were in just didn't have enough graze for their herds. And it caused some problems. And of course they split. And the next part of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is going to be next. Thank you. I apologize for our issues this morning.